Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hey, it's Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. You know the websites, JackieCation.com, DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com, FamilyPetAncestry.com. You're probably already there. Let's do the credits. Mike Rickberg composed and sang that song with his wife, Sarah, that you just heard. He's going to sing his version of the Mexican Hat Dance at the end of the program. Patrick Brady is going to fix this audio, and Vilmos works on JackieCation.com. The website. There are many ways to support the show. The Amazon link is one. You can use an Amazon link from JackieCation.com or DorkForest.com to go to Amazon. You order like normal and it supports the show. There is a straight up donation button, PayPal or Venmo to this email address that is mine, Jackie at JackieCation.com, where you can just donate to the show if you like the show a lot. I think PayPal has figured out a way to do a monthly. If you want to go monthly, please do. Other ways to support the show if you want to is you can buy merch. There's Dork Forest t-shirts, and all the shirts are union made here in America, so they run a little big. Union Bayside, so if you want to look up their size chart. And then the other merch is my stand-up merch. On JackieCation.com, you can watch me do stand-up, you can look at my schedule, and the stand-up merch, a couple of different t-shirts, couple of different enamel pins, and all of my CDs and my DVD. If you want to live stream my DVD, it's over there at comedyfilmnerds.com. They have a live streaming capability, or you can get a hard copy of the DVD on my website. Oh, there are premium episodes at Bandcamp. TheDorkForest.bandcamp.com has probably 10 episodes that were done live. They cost me a couple of bucks to make, so I charge you a couple of bucks. If you've run out of regular episodes, go over to TheDorkForest.bandcamp.com and get some more. Other than that, I say this, let's get into the show. Hey, it's Jackie Cation and I'm in the living room. I am here with a friend of Carmen Morales's. So we've never met, but you, let's first of all, is it Balaker?
It is.
All right, Matt Balaker. Why didn't I ask before we started recording? Because that's what I'm like. You are a huge fan of Greg Giraldo's.
Yeah.
And she was like, it's to the point of dorkiness, is what Carmen said. And I was like, calm down. It's you can be a fan. Karen Kilgariff one time did a podcast a lot about Sandra Bullock.
Mm-hmm.
But it weeded off, because there's only so much about one person really you can stalk or stan or whatever right. The current version of that word is. And but you have written a book, just so people know.
Yeah, I think if you spend 5 years on a book about one guy, you can definitely call yourself a dork to the subject. Right. So one of my dorkdoms is definitely Greg Giraldo or Greg Giraldo Studies.
Right, Greg Giraldo Studies. The Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story by you, Matt Balaker, and a guy named Wayne Jones, clearly a friend.
He is now. He's
right.
He's a,
oh, at the time, it was...
We're actually enemies at first. No, the starter from a Kickstarter campaign, and Wayne is in Northeast Canada.
Okay.
And so through the power of Kickstarter, we met, and he's an academic librarian and an author. So he added a whole new level of dorkiness, especially when it came to endnotes and documenting all our sources.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, that's hilarious. By the way, so... If you want to find Matt online, it's GregGiraldoBook.com, and then it's at GregGiraldoBook on all the things, Twitter, Instagram, all the things.
That's
and
true.
Giraldo is G-I-R-A-L-D-O, Giraldo. So, and you're Balaker, B-A-L-A-K-E-R.
You're Matt so Balaker. Good.
Sure. Let's get it out of the way, because the thing is we can talk about Greg, but I love the additional list of dorkdoms that you sent. That was always fun for me. And because Greg Giraldo... Yeah, let's. So, what brought you? I mean, you're younger than he would be.
I am, yes.
So, were you like 11 and you're like, I fell in love with him because he's so fucking funny?
I wasn't quite 11. I was in my early 20s when, when Tough Crowd.
Tough Crowd, was it?
It was tough. Actually, before then, Jackie, I interned briefly at Conan O'Brien.
Oh.
Like around 2000.
Oh, did you?
And Greg had. I'll call him Greg because
sure,
I wrote it. So we're on a first name basis.
Yeah.
He was doing stand up occasionally on the show.
Yeah.
And I remember he had this joke about gay muscle.
Yeah.
It was a different way of doing it. Like,
right.
And it was so funny and unique. And I remember a lot of the other interns were like, this guy's really good. So that sort of planted the seed for my interest in him.
Oh, fair enough. So it was in like 2000-ish.
Yeah.
And I met him. I worked with him twice in the 90s. Back in the 90s.
Back in the 90s, yes.
And so always delightful to work with. Amazing.
And where did
to
you
watch.
Work with him?
At the Knuckleheads at the Mall of America in Minneapolis.
Minnesota? Oh, cool. Huh?
Yeah, so I think it was both times we're there. And I don't know, when did he pass? When did he die?
In 2009. Sorry, 2010. It's September 2010.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So it was, I believe it was in like the late 90s, and then it was in the early 2000s that I worked with him. So, because Knuckleheads was, it's a large venue, mm-hmm. and it still is. It's a house of comedy, seats like 450. Too big. Anyway, but so you got to meet him on Conan?
I didn't meet. I watched him. I met him in California a couple times, and by meet, it was like I bought his CD, shook his hand, and I told him, "Thank you very much."
Literally,
for coming here.
Yeah, yes. That's how I met.
On to the next person.
Exactly. I met Don Rickles like that.
He didn't have a chance to roast you during.
No. It's we didn't have a. I had just enough time for me to make him uncomfortable, for how much I was like, "You're Don Rickles." Very comparable. I met George Wallace a couple of years ago. Was nice. Also a little intense.
Okay.
I gotta maybe work on that. It doesn't necessarily. Nobody needs that. And so what made you write the book? Quite honestly, I mean, like, did you just end up collecting all of his stuff and?
Sort of. Like most comics, I had a day job.
Oh, do you do stand up?
I did. In fact,
Morales, why bury the lead?
I ran a show. In West Hollywood on Sunset. Called Ball Games Laugh Lounge from 2006 to 2012.
Okay.
And we had a lot of great comics.
Sure.
Mostly West Coast guys. And like Greg Fitzsimmons, he was kind of like East Coast, West Coast. Geraldo was always a guy.
2006 to 2012. I was here. Why didn't I do that?
I think
gig?
You tried. And okay. You're like, oh, I get zero money and maybe 10 minutes. But I would have given you a free drink, Jackie.
Well,
that's what it.
In 2006, I was definitely driving to West Hollywood, so I must not have known about it, which is.
Well, it's too bad because we would have loved to have you.
Yeah, it would have been.
I think we had Lori Kilmartin, like a lot of the people you perform
my cohorts,
with. Yeah,
sure. They're in Fitz Dog, sure.
And so, you know, I as a performer, that was a good way to get stage time because, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of offer other people spots and they'd put you onto rooms. But every now and again, Greg Giraldo would come to town and it was always my goal to get him on my stupid show.
Right.
And he didn't do it. But I think one time he got back to me and was very cool about it.
Oh, that's cool.
And he was a guy, this was kind of when social media was just beginning. And nowadays, it seems like we know far too much about everyone.
Right.
Giraldo was kind of the opposite. Like, I knew he went to Harvard Law. I knew he had this addiction issue.
Yep.
But he also did a style of comedy that I think me and I mean, so many others aspired to be. You know, like,
right.
He was intelligent but approachable.
Yeah.
And so I think it was this combination of being a comic, looking up to him. I mean, he was certainly an idol,
sure.
comedically, but also not knowing a lot about him. So there was a curiosity there.
Ooh, a man of mystery.
Yeah, it's like, ooh, yes. This forbidden fruit. And then
it was.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the mystery was, there wasn't a lot there.
Right.
Don't worry about it. It's he was a good guy, but oh, go ahead.
Oh, and then when he passed, he was the first public figure that when he died, I broke down and was just bawling.
Oh, wow.
And I was an a-hole because living in L.A., was there when lots of celebrities died.
Right.
And I remember when, I think it was like Michael Jackson or even earlier, I remember Princess Diana.
Right.
I just didn't get it. Like I mean,
right.
I understood like, oh, you might have admired their art or you looked up to what Princess Diana did about like landmines or something.
Yeah, right.
But to actually have this emotional connection, like
with someone you did not know.
I was like, how phony, how disingenuous is that? And then when it's someone I looked up to,
right.
I was like, oh, slap in the face.
Right,
like,
right.
I get it now. Like I felt like, some
that's
connection
real.
To him.
That's
yeah.
super real. I mean, I remember as a kid when I think Jimmy Stewart died or mm-hmm. somebody like that, and my stepmother was Elvis, and when Elvis died and when John Lennon died, actually much more than Jimmy Stewart because Jimmy Stewart was old.
Like it's sad, like, but it's the natural course of events.
It's not a career
events.
Cut tragically short right, when Jimmy Stewart.
He was
passed.
97. No,
yeah, exactly, something like that. And then, but when like John Lennon died. It was bananas. I mean, she was just like, And I didn't get it either. And I was, you know, 13 or 14, and I was just like, what's happening? He's a Beatle. Okay. Do you even have any Beatles albums? And she was like, I did. Your oldest brother took them. And I was like, calm down. All right. Not. I'm sorry I brought it up. And but yeah, I think that that's a real thing, because I can't remember the first person. I remember being super shocked when Kinison died.
Yeah.
And because he was the first comic. I when I first started, it was Bill Kinison, his brother, owned the club.
And in so Houston, right?
Or in Madison, Wisconsin. Okay. They were. It was a bad idea. Anyway, but Bill had this club in Madison. So I got to meet Sam, I think just once or twice as well. Much like, you know, and even though I worked with him for that week, he was drunk and coked up and looking for love and
Sam
all the wrong places.
Greg.
Sam.
Okay.
Yeah. And but when he died, I remember being super shocked, because I didn't know people. I didn't really know, like, it's weird when people die.
And he died of a car accident.
He was.
And he was apparently sober. I mean, that's.
Right. Supposedly, yeah. He was driving with his newlywed stripper wife, and someone has to, and so, you know, the thing is I always wonder, because I would meet these women that these guys would bring around, like Bill Maher would bring around these just women, and you're like, who are you that you're hanging out with this dude? Do you think, I mean, I never know about the women who date really creepy male comics.
Right,
you're
right.
Just like, do you think he's funny?
Who's more disturbed in this equation?
Or are you just very interested in cash and prizes?
Right.
Which you know, there are plenty of men and plenty of women who hang out with people for cash and prizes, and I don't begrudge them that. But I was always I never got to really talk. Like, I would love to talk to any one of the number of hookers that Bill Maher has around him at all times.
He's like, come on in,
he
do the podcast.
He loves a tiny black woman, mm-hmm. and. Like three of them. It's very weird. So they're all at work. They're at work. He's their job. Mm-hmm. And I would have loved to have talked. I opened for him one time in San Francisco at Cobb's. And he had this entourage with him, and he didn't let me stay in the green room. Oh. He was like, I need this.
I've got other plans.
Right. He said that he said, I need this room. Hmm. And I was like, well, I'll go hang out in the coat rack downstairs. It'll be fine. And he didn't even hear me. But he was like, oh, thank you. So he has knee-jerk reactions to social situations.
Interesting.
But I would have loved to have, while he was on stage, it was an hour 15. It wasn't like I was going to watch it. I watched the first 20. It was fine. Mm-hmm. And then my husband came and got me and said, you got to see the last 20. There's trouble.
Uh-oh.
And the last trouble was all about how nobody could make him get married. And you're like, who's making you? What's happening? And so
was he your husband at the time? Were you
my husband.
Were you guys married?
We were married, okay. And he saw Bill Maher. And Bill Maher was doing this whole thing about how nobody could force him to get married.
Gotcha.
And so he came and got me. So he was like, this is painful. I don't understand what he's doing. The first 40 wasn't bad. And I said, no, the first 20 wasn't bad. Anyway, so we had that conversation. Anyway, so how many times did you get to see him live?
Two or three times. The best time, Jackie, was when he was doing the Insomniac tour. Mm-hmm. By tour, it was like three shows. But
right.
It was with Dave Attell, Sean Rouse, rest in peace, and Dane Cook.
Okay.
And that was, I think, the perfect blend of him being healthier, kind of at a good place mentally.
Okay.
And just peak comedically. This was probably, I think it was around 2006.
Okay.
When that tour happened. Then I saw him about a year, maybe 11 months before he passed in Irvine.
Right.
And it was around my birthday. And mm-hmm. I invited my in-laws, my wife, pretty much anyone. I was like.
Right. You're like, everybody come see
everyone
this guy.
And I couldn't have talked him up more. I was like, he'll part the Red Sea. He'll walk on water. And he was very good.
Oh, good.
But
right.
He wasn't up to his usual standard. But in a way, it didn't matter because I was so excited to see him. But
yeah.
After doing research and realizing, oh, he was just going through a divorce. He was going through all this mental issues. Like
second divorce or?
Well, it didn't complete. But
okay.
Yeah, he was married once and divorced. So
yeah.
Technically, he never finished the divorce, but they were separated.
Okay.
And so he'd been dating again.
So he had had his current, he had one wife is what you're telling me.
He had two wives. His starter wife, Jackie, was like, when he was at a very different place, he just really became a comedian. But when they met, he was a lawyer or law student.
Right.
And actually before that, but she was a dentist.
Okay.
And so it was a very almost stereotypical picture perfect two professionals from the same neighborhood in Queens, more or less. And then
did they meet in college?
They did meet in college at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And then less than a year later they were divorced, and he was like 23, 24 at the time.
So essentially he was doing law, they'd met in college, they'd been dating for several years.
Yeah.
And then they got married. The marriage lasted a year. And during that year, he started doing stand-up?
More seriously. Because, as you know, when you start, he was an exception where he actually became professional quickly. But you still have to, generally have to work something. And, right. And he was still working as a lawyer.
Yeah, some people, I have met, there's only one other comic who started headlining within a year of open mic that I saw. And he also started kind of late. Though Greg would have been how old? Like 25 or 26?
Yeah. Yeah. When he started, okay. He was about that. Because I guess when you finished law school, he was about 25. Yeah. So he was about 25 when he picked up a mic.
Right. When he first started.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. He also, but the thing is 25, 26 with the skill level of being a lawyer would help your stage presence and all these things. And he was clearly very smart, but he was pretty good looking. I mean, he had sort of that sort of Italian good looks.
That didn't hurt. But when you look at some of the pictures from law school, he was kind of doughy.
You're a little chubbier?
A little chubbier. Aww. Well, I mean, when you're sitting at a desk all day and mm-hmm. it's not great for the obliques.
No, but drinking a lot and not eating anything.
That too.
Right, that'll thin you right up.
Drinking 4,800 calories of booze, it's probably not good for your waistline either.
Well, except for that you probably pass out before you eat anything and you throw up.
That's true.
So that's probably what trimmed him up real nice. And good for him,
One of the benefits of overdrinking.
And there was only, and it's weird, I have, there's several movies where women comics succeed within a year, and it's like this huge thing,
right.
And you're like, I've never met a woman comic who's blown up that fast, that quick. I don't know. I guess that's not true. In the last 15 years, I've seen mm-hmm. a couple of those. But like back in the day, like there were just movies about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a grind, right? I mean, but there was a guy named Dave Mordahl who was on the first Last Comic Standing, Minneapolis comic. Had a bromance with Rich Voss.
Nice.
Those are the two. They were sort of the ones they hung out all the time and made fun of Dad Fan, poor thing. Anyway, but Dave was probably in his early 30s, though, and he started doing stand-up, and he had enough life experience, and he had enough confidence that his stuff was funny from the start, and and his stage presence was great. So I bet you that's what it was with Greg.
Yeah, he was a natural. I mean, I'm sure he definitely got better over time, like any performer. However, amongst his peers at the open mic or mm-hmm. the bringer shows, he stood out from the rest. Might have been, he was maybe 3 years older than some of them, maybe not, but he was just had that intelligence and that confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that pushed him because he was only working as a serious lawyer for not even a year at the big firm. And then he kind of straggled on just to make money.
Yeah.
But I think once he got that little taste of being a performer,
I think
he never let it go. Yeah.
Not everybody, but some people, it's just that. It's like heroin. Like you try doing stand-up and you're like, oh, this is what I do now.
Yeah, what was your first stand-up memory? You did heroin and then you got on stage?
Yeah, essentially. I've never done heroin, but it was exactly like that. And it was in 1984, so it wouldn't have been... blessedly, it was never recorded.
I'm so glad mine wasn't.
I have friends who have them, and I'm just like, put it as private, and then that'll be funny. If you're still doing it 20 years from now, you can post it, and that'll be hilarious, and that'll be fun for everyone. But I forget with Greg. So he lived in New York too. Also helped.
Yeah, he grew up in Queens. Then he had a job at Skadden Arps, which was like the Rolls Royce of law firm. I mean, it was like to many, and this was interesting, like that was a bigger deal.
Yeah.
You know, among the lawyer community than graduating from Harvard Law.
Right. Because
I guess Harvard Skadden wouldn't take just any Harvard grad. You had to be
right. There was
a certain one.
Right. You had to be a certain kind of Harvard grad. Yeah. That's interesting. Oh, that's there's part of it that's a great loss to the law. the fact that he started
there,
doing
there would have
stand-up.
Been a funny lawyer who, yeah.
It would have been a very
you lost
smart,
out on.
Well, the thing is I mean, because he always, I think, like, what I really liked about him on Tough Crowd specifically, and I didn't watch the show a lot, is Colin Quinn older than him?
Yeah.
Okay. So if how old would Greg be today?
54.
Okay. So, and how old is Colin? Like 58?
Probably 60.
Okay.
I'm guessing. I don't know.
5 or 6 years yeah. older? Okay. So, yeah, because what I liked about him on Tough Crowd was how he tempered all of the weird, you know, sort of shock jock shit.
Well said.
Yeah, because he wasn't a shock jock comic. He had very dark, very shocking premises.
He could go there if he had to.
He went there, but it was never, but it was usually in response to something they said. He was just sort of stacking on top of it or riffing off of it. And then if he wrote his own very dark material, it was usually much smarter and
right.
not kinder, but not as mean.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't, it didn't come from this, it's sort of like Stanhope in the way that Stanhope does a lot of very misogynistic jokes, but they don't ever come from this place of hate.
Yeah, well
like,
said.
I've seen old women laugh at Stanhope, where you're just like, ah, look at that young man who wants to jerk off in my face.
Isn't that cute?
And you're like, how cute is he?
He's
and you're
adorable.
Like, such a weirdo. Anyway, but it's...
well, and that's strange, yeah, because Tough Crowd was like is a perfect element for him, because he was very prepared on the show, but then inevitably someone would say something... And then his improv skills would come through.
Right, right.
But it wasn't like he just would wing it. You know, he had to have an idea what to say, and then
I did Tough Crowd once, and they give you the topics before. Mm-hmm. So there was work that could be done if you were willing to do it. And it was with the rest of those guys, you know, I think Colin had people writing for him, obviously.
Yeah.
But everybody else just, you know, we're sort of like, okay, that's the topic. I'm going to look at an article.
Right.
And, you know, and it's, yeah, there was, I didn't, it's, it wasn't, I think that Colin Quinn is very funny, but it isn't, some of those other guys I never found them funny. So I was like, oh, okay. I mean, it's not that Jim Norton doesn't have a fascinating story about his life, right? It's he
very
often does.
Yeah.
Right. The guy's a disaster of a human being trying to stay above water. So that is, I mean, who doesn't want to watch a two-legged dog fucking dance?
Right.
I will watch that. But it's it was so interesting, and it made sense why Geraldo took that gig, because it's a gig and it was very popular.
And it's consistent work.
And it was steady work, $4.50 an episode. Who doesn't need $450? And but the weird thing is, then he hangs out with those guys, and those guys to hang out with those guys, I would have to be drunk. You know, it was the thing is, I mean, they couldn't make me drunk, but they could make me very thirsty, just to even be around those fucking dudes, just because the riffing is gross usually.
Yeah.
You know, like I've hung out with Keith Robinson and Jim Norton, and them talking about going down and finding 14-year-old virgins down in South America is inappropriate and hard to continue to eat your eggs while you're trying.
Wait, I just got an omelet. Can you,
right,
can you wait till I'm finished?
I'm trying to eat over here.
I'm going to put Tabasco sauce on
right.
it.
Yeah. I mean, the worst thing Geraldo ever said to me was, oh, I'm in between cheating on my wife right now.
Oh.
And that was the first time I met him, because he was trying desperately to stay sober. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay. Weird.
And it wasn't sticky?
No, he was trying to be funny, but he wasn't kidding.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he's just riffing. He was literally, the first time I worked with him, I didn't hang out with him much the second time because I loved his stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't hang out with him because it was too sad. Because he's genuinely, I can't fix him.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And you're broken. You're, and you can't fix yourself. You, and so
when did you know that he was broken? Because he was,
it was a Tuesday through Sunday.
Okay.
So I knew, I knew by Thursday or Friday.
Cause some, he did a good job of hiding. Like, I mean, we interviewed around 70 people.
Right.
Some like you knew right away. It also depended how they met.
Yeah.
But like his lawyer friends or his like non comedy friends, like, you know, he was very sober around me and
sure. Well, and the thing is he was sober the first week I met him. And so, but and I don't think I was.
Okay.
And so he just wanted to sit around and shoot the breeze and I was featuring for him and he was bored and it was, you know, you're on the road. And so we hung out a bunch. And so, but we didn't, you know, I wasn't sleep with the headliner feature, right? That wasn't
good
my
for you. Why
that
not?
Wasn't my jam.
wasn't in your rider, yeah.
Well, there were some headliners I wanted to sleep with. He wasn't one of them. Mm-hmm. I think I've realized recently that the headliners I want to sleep with, I'm funnier than them. Geraldo, I don't think I was funnier than him. He was funnier than I was.
So that turned you off. You're like, yeah. I can't get excited.
Much like most male comics who don't want to sleep with women who are funnier than they are, I couldn't face it. I was like, nah, he's going to be funnier than I am.
It hits him right in the insecurity.
Yeah. Why don't I just watch him do stand-up and like him as a friend? And then
that's a good choice.
But this guy who is very, like, there were guys who were super funny and are very, very funny, but I think of myself as funnier than they are, just because my ego is as big as their ego.
Sure.
So they would probably think that they're funnier than I am, but I like them enough to sleep with them, but I never slept with them either.
Gotcha.
Because either I was funnier than they were in their mind, they're like, why bother? That's just going to get, what if I enjoy it?
So that's the analysis before getting in the sack. They're like, how'd you close tonight?
As a road comic? In the 90s and the 80s, I have to say yes. It's not the greatest.
It wasn't the eyes or the chest the way he made you feel.
The physical attributes, it was entirely
was he a good listener? Yeah.
Well, it was entirely intellectual. And like, because, you know, guys were handsome or good looking and made more so by being funny. It was just whatever it was. But but Geraldo, such a great comic. I mean, literally, when he died, I was like, well, that is a fucking waste. Because it was like Hedberg, you know, because I never wanted to sleep with Hedberg either because he was funnier than I was. And, but Hedberg was the same kind of thing where you're like, and also a sweetheart, you know, a super, super sweet guy. And Greg was always very nice to me. And what I liked about him when, even drunk, he wasn't a mean drunk. He was, because the second time he was hammered the whole time. And he was
the second time in at the Mall of
Knuckleheads. Yeah, the second time I worked with him. And he was very drunk. And I was like, and he just looked at me. And I don't know that he remembered me. Because, you know, it's hard when you work with somebody, because I don't remember all the features. I mean, it's hard. There's too many comics, right? So I remembered him because you remember, you usually, you know, as you come up, you remember the headliners. And like I've worked with Chris Titus three times.
Nice to meet you every time.
Every time. Well, and I do that to people too. But my favorite thing was about a year and a half ago, I did a set at Flappers. He came up to me from the audience. He was like, who are you? You're great. And I was like, thank you. Thank you very much. In other news.
Here's a picture of us from 7 years ago.
We worked at Knuckleheads and then we worked at the Punchline in Sacramento. So good. Whatever happens, man. In 2003. So what? So he never did get divorced, his wife and kids.
Well, when he was 23.
Oh,
or
right, right.
That.
But the second one, his kids.
They were separated and he moved out of the house.
First,
no, not his first wife.
Yeah.
He had three with his second, the longest tenured. And she had to kick him out of the house.
Yeah.
And we talked with her. She was one of the initial interviews we did. And that was so important for me because...
That's amazing that she was willing to do that.
I can't have more respect for her. And that was so eye-opening for me, Jackie, because it showed how selfish, in a way, a lot of us fans are just... I'll call them people in the comedy community are. Like, I was upset that I wasn't going to see his next joke about
Right.
George Bush or who knows what, you know, or whatever, whatever it was. And then I talked to this woman and like, oh yeah, you have three kids.
Right. Who are never going to get to know their dad.
And you can't, I mean, she had to, I'm sure she mourned, but in the grieving process, she also has to, you know, make lunches, get her kids to school,
yeah.
You know, do all the everyday stuff that
of parenting. Single parenting.
And all of us are like, oh, what a genius. And you know, she's clearly loved him,
yeah.
But that genius was also making their life so hard because, right. because I don't want to say, well, he just shouldn't have drank. I mean, he had depression issues that he was self-medicating very poorly.
You know, and but, to say someone shouldn't drink, best of luck.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you really shouldn't put that in your body. It turns out it's bad for you.
You have an illness, and I'm so sorry that you can't cure it yourself. And but you can't cure it yourself, so he was kind of fecocked. But so they got married...
In 95.
You know what this is? Yeah. We could just totally gossip about his marriage. Because I have always wondered about her because when I first met him, he was very nice about her. He was just like, she was great. He had gotten his first development deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he blew all the money in Vegas.
Oh.
And $50,000. He blew $50,000 in a weekend in Las Vegas. And he finally ended up
checking. Did he gamble at all or was it all on drugs?
It was all of it. It was gambling, oh, okay. Drugs, women.
Vice of your choice.
All the things of Las Vegas.
Right.
And he said that he checked his messages finally. And there was a message from her. There were several messages from her. But the last one said, if you don't call me, I'm taking our children and you're never seeing them. And so that's what had sobered him up that when I first met him. It's just fear, right?
Yeah.
Just fear had sobered him up. He was white knuckle, like holding on for dear life to try to keep his family and to keep his, you know, but not able for some reason to get sober more than that, right? I mean, for some reason.
He could be so, and this is the sad part of it. Like you can be sober 99% of the time and go off the wagon that one day
and
that's the end of you. And I'm not saying he was sober 99%, but from when he met Marianne, it was.
How did they meet? Do you know?
She worked at Caroline's. She worked in Saturday Night Live in the cue card department. She had a moonlighting gig, serving drinks.
Okay.
And she was also Latin. She just came back from Spain. She worked at the 92 Barcelona Olympics. So they had a little bit more to talk about. I think she spoke Spanish too.
Right.
So
he was not Italian. What the hell
no,
was
no,
he?
No, he's Colombian and Spanish.
Thank God. Okay. So it'd be like me saying,
goodness,
it was like Fred Armisen's Italian, isn't he?
Yeah.
No, he's not. Anyway, so, but the...
So yeah, so they met, you know, he was gigging there.
Yeah.
And also they were New Yorkers,
yeah.
And so they had more in common than just, you work at a comedy club, I'm a comic.
Well, and the thing is you meet people, how many people meet everybody at work anyway?
Right.
You know, so I mean, it's hard to, it's why there's those rules of how you can't sexually harass people at work. And so that,
and I think
you gotta go gently into that dark
night.
You have
to go gently, absolutely.
You're like, do you want to date as people? I know we work together. I mean, you have to say those words and then they're like, yeah, I totally do. And then you dash off and you do whatever you want to do because you're both adults.
Exactly.
But that's how they met. She worked at Caroline's.
Yeah.
That's neat.
And
she didn't do stand up.
No, I mean, she was a designer. Designer, and so I mean, she was tangentially in the entertainment field, but
not
in a way that was competing with them. And also, she seems very like strong and not one to just be like, oh my god, he has cute eyes. You know, so I think
she fell in love with she had seen plenty of comedy, what I'm saying.
God, yeah, and at a point, you know, not to date comics, and I'm sure he got hit on by a lot of waitresses or whatever, but I think because it was a little more hard to get, and there was some substance there on both sides that actually resulted in a relationship.
Yeah.
And also I think because she was so strong, she could call him out on some of his shit. Now, that doesn't mean you can quote unquote fix someone who has that. But
she
it also
could take
mean,
care of herself enough.
Exactly. And like you said, Jackie, she would be the one to say, like, if you don't do this, I'm gonna take our kids and actually mean
right.
it. Whereas
right.
like if it was, you know, just some groupie,
yeah.
then be, oh, you do you, you know.
Right. Like if yeah, just to sort of, and it's kind of amazing. You know, that's lovely that they had that kind of relationship because you fear when somebody gets success, especially, mm-hmm. Like when did they marry?
95.
In 95. So, and then he passed in 2008 or 9, you said? Or
2009, yeah.
And so, all right, so 15 years.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. They married in 99.
Okay.
They met around, sorry, because that was, he got sober for the first time in 2005. So that's okay. Like confusing. It was 99, I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah. So, and then, so they were together 10 years.
Yeah.
And they both did the best they could, and it just didn't go. That so the kids, the oldest can't be more than 10 when he passes,
right?
Yeah, and now that kid's 20,
mm-hmm.
If that.
And they're doing well. I mean, I got to interview Marianne a few times, and they're her priority,
sure,
understandably.
Yeah,
but you know they're very proud of.
Yeah, they're proud of what, you know, his work.
And they focus, and not in like a naive way, like he was a saint, and no one who knew him will ever call him a saint. But he did some amazing things.
I can't imagine he'd call himself a saint.
Yeah, and his love for his kids, that everyone who knew that they always brought that up. And that was pretty cool.
And her, quite honestly.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was weird, him, the whole thing about him talking about screwing around on his wife when he so clearly respected her, but not in any sort of actions. But he so clearly respected her and loved his children so much, loved and respected all of those people that were his immediate family. It was lovely to see that, and it was, I think, you know, it's not bad company, you know, because there are the people, both men and women, but I have mostly met men who will encourage you to screw around. They're just like, well, you're not there. I mean, I worked the first three years I was on the road, I never met a male comic who didn't cheat on his wife.
Wow.
And when I did, I literally called someone.
you'll never guess what I just found out. He went home and he slept by himself.
Yeah. Fred Klett, you guys. He'd have a beer and a half and then he'd head back to the hotel. And it was amazing.
Like, he must be gay.
And but his wife was very beautiful, and he had a couple of kids, and he was a nice man. And he was also genuinely really funny. So I was like,
You're a unicorn. Yeah.
It was a delight. And I've since met many male comics who do not cheat on their spouses, just so we all know.
Okay, the record states
that it's a numbers game, and I've met thousands and thousands of men. So,
and four of them have not cheated on their wives.
And plenty of them are decent. Plenty of them. So, but there are still plenty of dudes who will encourage you not to be.
Sure.
Right? Just because they're pieces of shit.
And they want, like, other pieces of shit around them.
Right. They would better. Like some misery, would enjoy some company. And and I think that he did fall into a little bit of that, you know, because so when did he start doing stand-up? This is fascinating.
Yeah,
we're not talking about anything else.
1993.
Oh, okay, in 93. Ish, so.
Because he graduated from law school in 92, and then he was working at this law firm in New York City, and that's really where he started doing open mics that first year, because he's like, lawyer work sucks.
Yeah. So this is the book, by the way, is called Greg Giraldo, A Comedian's Story, and I'm talking with Matt Balaker. That sounds very Terry Gross.
I like it.
And you know what's interesting is that this book is entirely words. There's no that center spot that pictures.
Fast forward near the end. There's pictures. Yeah, there's about 15 of them.
Okay, there's pictures, but there's, you know, how like sometimes in the middle of like a biography there'll be the glossy shots in the middle. So is it broken into? Yeah, it is. Let's look at some. May I?
Of course. That's your
right.
book.
So, all right. So there's 13 chapters.
Well, and 10, I mean.
Of a sort, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a foreword by Colin Quinn. There's an introduction. There's some notes, and there's some photography. So the notes, that makes me think Wayne Jones was at work.
Wayne Jones was very hard at work, and hopefully no one will sue us, because we documented freaking... That took almost 7 months, just the documentation part of it.
Oh, that's amazing, though.
Such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So everyone out there, even if you don't read the story, please review the end notes. There's a lot of work.
Oh, right. Please. There's a lot of sources, you guys. A lot of work went into that.
These sources are amazing.
So, I mean, the thing is, so you've got, you know, like sort of
It's sort of by topic. Like it's there's like the early days.
And linear.
Linear, yeah.
And super, like the smart kid goes to how he's remembered. So this type of thing. And it feels like that you're, you interviewed how many people?
About 70.
Okay.
So and then there's at least that many sources, you know, right. From like articles or online clips.
Right. Just. Yeah, what has already been documented.
Right.
Right. So you talked to 70 people, and then you also took the stuff that was already available.
Absolutely.
And quoted that as well. So That's fascinating. And then did you quote his act at all?
Yeah.
Okay. Because there is a book, I don't know if it's on the shelf, but Stuart Lee, do you know him? He's a UK comedian. If you like Gert Giraldo, you would like Stuart Lee.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll check him out.
Stuart Lee is like, if Andy Kindler and Bill Hicks were one person.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it is. His stand-up is more like Hicks.
Yeah.
But he's more, he can be super meta like Kindler.
Okay.
So it is, and his book, it was about when he stopped doing stand-up for a couple of years. And it was him coming back in the first, and he transcribes the first 2 hours of his stand-up with annotations. And it is fascinating. I was like, this, you have balls the size of Gibraltar. It is outstanding. But if you look up Stuart Lee, and Stuart with a W, Lee, L-E-E.
Stuart Lee.
Yeah, he's delightful. And he's a British comic. And
there are excerpts from
his
comedy in this, because he's the central character of the story. And that was a little bit of a challenge, Jackie, because at first, especially with the comics, it's always like their interactions with Greg. So it's kind of a story of someone meeting Greg. And then we had to kind of
tease out the parts. Every story I have about Greg isn't about Greg. Yeah. It's about me meeting Greg.
Right.
Right. You're like, allow me to put this through a strainer and find the actual information about Greg. What year were we talking about? Where was he? Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So that's fascinating. And then what about his parents? Are his parents still alive? Really invade his personal life.
No, his mother is, as far as I know, at least when I was writing this book.
Did he have siblings?
He has two siblings.
Okay.
And his father passed away in 2002
from
esophageal cancer.
Okay.
But they were very close. In fact, Greg had a sitcom, short-lived, but it was in 96, it was when it aired, called The Common Law.
Yeah.
And the father figure in that was largely based off Greg's dad, Alfonso.
Okay. Yeah. And it was... that was one of his development checks. That's what he was talking about. So how many episodes was Common Law?
I think it aired four. Like the pilot and then three episodes or maybe two.
Right.
I think they filmed 13.
Oh, did they?
But most didn't air.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could get the DVD.
Yeah, I have.
And you have the DVD.
But there's some that are just lost. But one of the actors... provided some, and she lost a bit.
Okay.
And then I went to UCLA's film archive and watched some there. The pilot was, objectively good. You know what I mean?
90s sitcom.
Because it aired with News Radio. And then there was that show with Michael J. Fox.
Spin City.
Spin City. And I thought Spin City was
my
funny.
First spec.
Yeah. Oh, nice. So it was... right along with those, and the other shows lasted decades, and this one didn't. As I watched more of them, I'm no TV critic, but I thought the writing kind of suffered as the series went on.
So, oh, really?
So maybe they pushed all the good stuff at the beginning, but also this was at the time when Disney had purchased ABC, and so there was like this regime change. So the people that started the show had no vested interest in it. They're like, I didn't do this. Get the hell off of the air. Who knows why it didn't last?
It's a classic problem that you learn about in show business is that when there is a shakeup at any level, projects that were in process usually get abandoned because whoever takes over doesn't care. They're like, this isn't something I ever wanted to do. They're gone.
And then even if it did well, it seems like you could still benefit. But they're like, no, the ego is too strong.
It's I can't possibly continue this. And so you're like, okay, well, that's fine. But
he that was his only like sitcom. He had holding deals. He had development deals pretty much annually. And as you know, he was on with Andy Kindler on Last Comic Standing.
Yes.
But his TV, I mean, if after doing the research, I was like, he has a pretty impressive TV resume, but not really for someone with his talent.
Right. Well, it's a classic example of sometimes the industry doesn't know what to do with you. And
well said.
Yeah. Mitch Hedberg used to do that joke about how, you know, you spend 15 years learning how to do stand-up comedy, and they're like, oh, can you act? And you're like, maybe. And it'd be like if someone had spent 15 years studying to be a chef, and they're like, what we'd really want you to do is become a farmer.
Can
and
you
you're like, and you're like,
how are your planting skills?
Sort of adjacent. I can try. I did not actually know that Kindler and Geraldo were on a season of Last Comic.
Yeah, they were judges.
With
Natasha Leggero. In fact,
Leggero. Okay.
And that
would have been like fourth or fifth season. Okay.
I think it was the seventh, but I'll check my notes. But it wasn't sequential. The show had.
I didn't remember Greg was a judge. I remember Andy being a judge.
Did Andy just talk over him or?
I
remember when he was a judge. I didn't watch it.
I did season 2, 3, and 4.
Okay.
Every year they would tell me that. I was going to make the top 10. And then every year I would not make the top 10. And
so someone in showbiz was disingenuous to you,
there
Jackie.
There was some
is
sort of disingenuousness going
in this city.
Shocking that someone might lie to a person who was working for them.
What?
I know it. And I think that the level that I was getting lied at, they were like, maybe it'll work. Yeah. I hope it works.
We did it last year. Just do it again.
Right. And then, you know, it sort of came out that I just wasn't nuts enough. And I was like, oh. Well, you should have told me. I would have acted more crazy.
You weren't there for the reality show component.
Right. I needed. They needed more insanity. And I was like, oh, shit.
You were a well-versed stand-up. And they wanted nothing.
They wanted no part of that. It was when I was – there was a very, very new comic. It was the third year that I did it. And they asked me to do it again the following year. And I was like, oh, no, we're done. When I'm standing next to Esther Koo and you pick her for the thing and not me. And it's not that Esther Koo isn't a perfectly good comic,
right?
But she was so new at the time that she wasn't that great a comic. She's a better comic now than she was then for sure. And, but I was like, no, I'm done now. And, so I just fucked up.
That's yeah. Geraldo had a funny roast joke about Rich Voss.
Oh, yeah?
And it was before he did Last Comic, but he said something like, Rich Voss shows after 20 years of doing stand-up, you can beat out 4 open micers for a spot on the most degrading show in the history of television.
Right. I think I liked my favorite tough crowd comment, I think, was Lisa Lampanelli sitting next to Voss and going, I love how you pretend that you're not 50. Yeah,
put another ring in your ear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That was awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you end up watching most of the tough crowds for this or just in general?
Because
you were a giant fan.
I was a fan of tough crowd. I was a fan of Greg's. And then I enjoyed the roasts.
Yeah.
That wasn't my and I loved his performances on there. That wasn't my favorite version of him.
Okay.
But it was very good.
Right. So how many albums does he have?
2.
He only has 2 albums?
And only one was, they had Good Day to Cross a River, which I think was a half hour. And then Midlife Vices, which he filmed shortly before his death. Which, if you watch it now, it's very foreshadowing.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, that's actually Sound Exchange money wise devastating for his family because of the passive income that is radio play.
Yeah.
Of all of his bits would have been awesome.
Well, they're still out there. To my knowledge, the family does get some benefit from.
Sure, they
from,
do, but only 2 albums worth as opposed to because I have
true.
4 albums. And
by today's standards, he'd have 19 Netflix specials this year. I think
right, and granted, Netflix would take all of that money.
Oh, yeah,
but maybe not because he might be able to negotiate a better deal because of who he was. And for the most part, all the new comics who have Netflix specials, it's a buyout,
right?
And they never see another dime, and then they rip them into CDs, and then they sell them to Sirius, and then they get all the residual money. So the whole thing is a bit of a debacle.
Okay.
Financially, just for the artist.
Yeah.
It's all working out for Netflix.
Sure.
Just in case you were worried about Netflix making their nut.
I was concerned.
their day-to-day. So are there other, like, is this the first book you've written?
It is. Yeah.
That's a trip. You're like, I want to write a book.
I was editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper.
That's not enough.
I could write a book in my mind. So it was a classic case of ignorance is bliss. I was like, I've done comedy for 10 years while doing novel. Why not?
That's funny. That you know, if I hadn't been editor-in-chief of my school newspaper, I might have fallen for that. Because the thing is that is the kind of thing you would
like,
lie yourself.
I was a journalist, and I think half the people on the paper were editors-in-chief. So.
It was, well, the task itself, I would say that my advisor was more the editor-in-chief.
Okay.
And, I mean, I did what I could, but sure. It was... whatever. So the fact is you published it, and how long did it take to,
you know, just quick 5 years later we're done.
Well, no, I mean, the thing is you want it to be good, right?
Yeah. And because it was a Kickstarter campaign, Jackie, I think a good piece of advice is public humiliation can work.
Oh, really?
Because when I said that, you know, however many, it was like 69-70 people backed it, but to those people,
yeah,
if I didn't finish it, I would have just been
a-hole.
You know, yeah, there's like, oh, but you said, and I gave you $14, so
right.
If you renege on this. And so that pushed me through. And also having a writing partner like Wayne, it's not a linear process. It's not like, okay, 1 month we'll do a chapter. It's like,
right.
You know, you realize, okay, some areas are kind of thin, and then a month or two before we thought we were publishing, we get a call from his old frat brother.
Oh.
And then there's like this whole new slew of content, and then that leads us to a rabbit hole of someone who's in a band with him. I was like, oh, I want to hear about him being in a band.
Right.
Of course I got. And then there's a new girlfriend from high school, and it's like, what? But we're trying to get this,
we're trying to
finish it, and all this stuff would happen.
Oh, that's awesome. So what did it delay some of the publication?
Yeah.
Okay. In the end, we thought we'd put out the book that we wanted to put out instead of being slave to when it was told, said that it was going to come out.
And I think I said, you know, after the Kickstarter a year, and I had no frame of reference. I was like, that sounds about
your first
right.
Kickstarter. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I'll.
Right.
Maybe it'll take 13 months, but it'll be pretty much a year.
Right. Right, because you're a hardworking guy, right?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, no, I can knock this
out. Yeah, yeah.
It's so who did the editing?
A couple people.
Right. Because you need to have...
That was such an important part.
It's such an important part of any book
need
feedback and you need clarity.
In fact, we went through a few editors and some, you know, it's kind of an example of you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
But Dorothea Halliday.
Yeah.
Cheryl Homburg did proofreading. But Dorothea, we gave her the first draft probably 2 or 3 years before it was done.
Yeah.
And it was so quote heavy. And she wasn't a fan of Greg. She just didn't know him.
Right.
And she tore it apart. She's like, this looks like an outline. It's not a book.
Oh, there you go.
You know, but she's like, here, you know.
Luckily, you had been doing stand-up, and you're like, oh, Jesus, okay, I can take horrible feedback.
I'm used to it.
I can hear it. I can hear how bad you didn't like this.
but then that was what we needed. But without that, it was good to have someone who wasn't like a comedy nerd.
Yeah.
Giving...
Just someone who... That was her job.
That was her job, and she was so good at it. And it I mean, there's a lot to be discouraged about as a creator, whether you're a comic or... writer or painter, but today there's so much do-it-yourself. Like I actually got in touch with her through an author named Jeff Benedict. My sister-in-law created a movie called Little Pink House. Plug.
There you go.
That was a book that Jeff Benedict wrote.
Okay.
But so she was his editor.
Okay.
But there are people like her.
Yep.
That are on all these websites where. If you know, go.
If you need an editor,
basically just say I'm looking for an editor, and you'll find someone who can do cover art.
Yeah.
Dan Dion, he's a pretty famous comedy
Dion.
Photographer. He took the picture of Greg.
Right.
So it's like one thing will lead to the next. So it's kind of like this democratization of creative people.
Yeah.
So it won't happen as fast as you want.
Yeah.
It won't be as cheap as you want. But there are far fewer barriers to entry than there were 15 years ago.
Right.
And so, but that doesn't mean you can skip a lot of the steps. Like, you could just put something on paper, put it on Amazon, and it'll be crap.
Right.
But if you have someone like Dorothea Halliday telling, you know, and pay what they're worth, your final product.
If you do it right,
you can. But you can do it right nowadays.
You can do it. You can do it right. There's because there used to be this vilification of self-publishing that you were some sort of amateur and that it was a desperate move because you couldn't get a publisher.
Absolutely.
But now, what you're saying is that you can do it right, and if you pay people fair, it can look like it can be a real piece of work. It could be an actual piece of art.
And these people, like Dorothea, she teaches somewhere at some college, I think. So, like, there are all these people who at night are different, doing different things, you know, because we have this insatiable need to have meaning.
Yeah.
And when you team up with people, it's really exciting because, you know, I didn't know much about how to document this stuff.
Yeah.
Wayne Jones did. I would not have cared at all, Jackie, 3 years ago, but now I do, you know, but it's like when you start it, it's exciting to see all of a sudden these people come to you or you find them, but you find them because you're pushing a project forward.
Right. That's great. Now, are you going to write another book, do you think? Or?
Probably, you know, after this is made into a $100 million movie.
Oh, interesting. Biopic. We're looking for the Elton John biopic.
I mean, there's enough
Giraldo.
Dying comedians to keep me busy for a while, I think.
Yeah, there's plenty of dying comedians. You can go you can go live.
Yeah.
Is there anybody who are the other comics that you I mean, he is a very unique voice in stand-up comedy.
Patrice O'Neill is one I would love to write a book about. However, Bill Burr is apparently doing a documentary on him.
Okay.
And I think it'll be fascinating. So
I literally never met Patrice, never saw his long set, have only seen 10-minute clips of his act. And but people love and he loved that fuck.
Yeah.
I'm like, he's all right.
Yeah.
But I'm clearly missing something. Or I'm not, and he's not for me. But there's plenty of that too. You know?
I didn't know as much about his stand up. I just think he's an interesting story. And I think a lot of it is the dying young of diabetes versus like drugs. You know, so there's some, but the Comedy Cellar to me is a fascinating kind of microcosm of comedic history.
Okay.
So I don't know if I'm going to do it, but I mean, a story that I'd like to hear told is the history of the Comedy Cellar.
Where did you grow up?
San Diego County.
Okay. Because it's so
Carlsbad,
funny.
Carlsbad, to be exact. But
no, sure. There's a small theater that that sometimes does stand up. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but doing any sort of, like, to pick a comedy club and to try to do the history of it and to talk about who came out of it. You know, like, there's people who, like, the Holy City Zoo in San Francisco with all those, like, Robin Williams and all those guys came out of that. Dana Carvey and whatever. But
Greg
if you
Proops,
go
probably.
Well, later it would have been Proops and Dana Gould and all those guys. But and then also Kilmartin and Sue Murphy and 1,000 women comics that nobody ever fucking mentions. But there was, like, have you seen that? Did you read that Klifterhoff or whatever his name was, The History of Comedy?
No.
There's the book looked fascinating. I cherry picked it because there's only so much stand up comedy I can carry.
Right.
I'm dipped. I'm in.
You can get your fill really quickly.
I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. But he did a history of stand up comedy book, and he mentioned like Joan Rivers. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Okay.
and Phyllis Diller maybe. But you're like, wow. Hey, man.
That's it. Yeah.
Shit.
Although Joan Rivers is a great one, but she's not the only.
She is not the only pillar. That the thing is if you were building, essentially, he was writing the history of Jewish male stand-up comics.
Maybe they need to revise the title.
Yeah, because it was only dudes, and it wasn't even, some of it kind of fell by the wayside in the fact I think he called Jerry Lewis a stand-up comic.
Oh, okay.
And you're like, what? I don't know. So in so much of stand-up comedy, many things are not for me. They weren't created for me. They don't even want me there.
Same here.
They would like me to fuck off.
Yeah.
They don't even want me in the green room unless I'm willing to listen to fisting jokes. They're like, if you're going to stay, don't like, be a bitch. Yeah. Don't be a bitch
you
about
didn't,
it.
You
just
didn't like
laugh.
My gaping joke? That was clever.
You're a gash. Just get the fuck out of the way. And you're like, Jesus Christ. Okay, I just want to go out to breakfast. Is that all right? It's like, you can come out to breakfast if you sit on my face. Club owner said that to me. Ooh. Thanks a lot, man. Yeah. In other news, where are we going to breakfast? And I'm not sitting in your face. Let's just go fucking. I just want to hang. I want to get work. Can I please just work for a living, you piece of shit? And but to write those books it's fascinating. It would be nice if, but you got to write about like someone like, because Geraldo was very much a very unique voice, I thought.
And it would have been boring if it was just stand up. Like when I get home, I don't know if you're this way. Like I don't watch much stand up.
No, I see a lot of.
I see a lot of live stand up. Yeah, but a lot what interested me about his life was the non stand up part,
like Harvard,
the leaving a white collar career, the being married and trying to be a comedian, the having mental issues, having addiction problems, trying to work it all out. You know. Trying to be a good dad and having the insecurity where you're around someone like Jim Gaffigan who blows up and you're like, oh, good for him, you know?
Good for him.
Yeah.
Well, there's that whole, I mean, there's just the entire generation of guys who came up with Drew Carey, right. Who are furious, is epic. You run into them all the time. They're dudes that are 55 years old that are like, I don't understand why Drew Carey got
famous.
We were
just there. We were neck and neck.
Yeah. Right. And you're like, well, some of it is just being in the right place at the right time. And other parts of it, he was more likable than you.
Right.
Certainly.
He might have sat on the club owner's face.
He might have. But he's certainly more likable than you right now. There's nothing more unattractive than bitterness, right?
Oh, God. It's like a disease, yeah.
And it's something you genuinely have to fight in stand-up comedy, mm-hmm. probably in plumbing, you know, and like in every industry where if you don't want to be mad at other people getting things that you don't get.
Yeah.
And there are real reasons. I mean, if you're a black gay comic, there's a freak show that you can get on once a month in Los Angeles. There's a reason to be angry. But the thing is it's not going to propel your career any faster if you dwell in that anger. It's one of the most amazing things I've seen is black comics, gay, whatever. I mean, people of color, right?
Yeah.
Just any comic who isn't a straight white guy, mm-hmm. who isn't angry. And who I have friends, I have black friends they're like, you have to spend a fair amount of your time, and they aren't comics.
Yeah.
They're just like, you have to spend a fair amount of your time as a black person making sure you're happy because they don't want you to be happy.
Right.
Fuck those people. I'm going to be happy. Watch me work very, very hard to be happy.
Absolutely.
And it's such a fascinating thing watching.
That reminds, like Natasha.
Leggero?
Yeah. She mentioned that. She knows of maybe two comics who are happy. And obviously it was somewhat tongue-in-cheek. But
she's riffing.
We have a chapter dedicated to that. And, you know, I don't know you personally, but everyone only says nice things about you, Jackie.
Well, that's nice.
And you seem like if I had to give an example of like someone who's is happy in comedy.
Yeah.
I would point to you, like, how would you characterize, like, are you happy in spite of comedy? Are you not happy? How would you answer that?
I think it's a great illusion that you have to not be happy to do stand-up comedy or to do art in any way, shape, or form. And you have to be this drunk. I mean, think about George Carlin. Mm-hmm. That guy died of old age.
Yeah.
In his bed. Like a person. Right?
Not human like human effing being.
Not like the genius that is George Carlin.
Yeah. Not with a syringe in his arm or something.
Right. Like that everybody was like, that guy was a genius. Of course he died young. And you're like, that guy was a genius, and Carlin's very funny.
Yeah.
Whatever. I've hit and miss for me, but everybody's almost hit. I'm hit and miss for me. So what are you going to do?
I mean, no one bats no one hits the ball every time you're in the league. You're going to have some misses.
It's the way it goes. But you can be happy. And that thing that my friend who's black said that to me. I had three friends right after the last election, mm-hmm. the presidential election, who said, because I was like, what do you do? What do you do now? I'm scared. And they're like, well, they want you scared and they want you to not be happy. And you could say And I had club owners. The guy who owned the comedy club scene in Minneapolis in 1990, when I moved there, was a guy named Scott Hansen. He had mm-hmm. five comedy clubs. Seven at one point, I think.
Wow.
And he genuinely, bit of a monster.
Oh.
Like, would pit comics against each other. And would try to make them... It was a competitive... He created a competitive atmosphere that wasn't real.
Okay.
That didn't benefit anyone.
He'd
but
be a great reality show producer.
Right, right. Yeah. Exactly. He was just trying to create drama because he was bored and he could.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you fall for that, and you do when you're very young, but you have to learn that lesson, the lesson of it takes some work to, because you're not going to be happy all the time, right? I mean, sometimes you're going to be.
That's not human nature.
Right. Please do not expect it. Clearly, yeah. Nobody's. But you can make sure that you take care of yourself enough that you do, like, hang around with people you love. Like, there are plenty of male comics and female comics that I don't hang out with. And I call those people my work friends.
Right. They're your
them,
colleagues.
Right. I don't invite them over to the house.
Right.
They're fun enough to hang out with and to riff with and then you leave. And then they go do, and if they're grouches or if they're super mean, they go do their grouchy mean thing.
Sure.
And then I go home and hang out with my husband, who is a delight. He is not always in a good mood either. None of
what?
Us are.
100% of the time he's not
right.
happy?
He's a game designer, but he has Weird. Different interests. And we have a lovely, we have a good, you know, we're at the very least, it's one of my, used to do a very an old joke about how what I've learned about relationships is that you should be polite. And one time I was on the phone and I hang up the phone and Andy Ashcraft, my husband, my loved one, said to me, you know, today, if you could be as polite as to me as you were to that customer service person, I would appreciate that. And I was like, holy shit, you are not wrong.
Yeah.
Because I was snippy and grouchy.
But that was so nice of
right
you
there.
To say that. Backward.
Right,
like my reaction if my wife said, "Well, he wasn't."
Well, yeah. I was frustrated with the customer service person
sure.
I was talking to because I was frustrated in general with I think my life, and so as we hung up, he was like, "You handle that really well, if I might say, if you could handle this that well, that'd be wonderful." and I was like, "Oh, good point," and I can, and that's a learned skill too, is to be
oh,
able
sure.
to hear the criticisms of your fellow humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I am relatively happy and it's great. And cause when I'm not happy, I also have the benefit of not having like clinical depression
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing and need for
it helps.
For drugs.
Not having,
right.
And when you're,
but I've had therapy.
Sure.
And there's times I think I would benefit from therapy again, but so there's nothing wrong with any of that.
And when it comes to your like creative output, do mm-hmm. you write better? Do you perform better when you're at a happy place, or
do you
actually. Take that angst and okay?
It's weird. It's not. We're so at an hour, but the okay. thing is I do write from a happy place because the jokes. If I wrote. There's probably an hour and a half of my material that's published and, mm-hmm. and more about my father. If I were, and initially those jokes started out as me very angry at my father, and then I processed that anger and I found you have to find, especially with your parents, what you love about them.
Mm.
You have to acknowledge that they are people, and if they are flawed people, they are flawed people. But there has to be something that is really good about them. If you can find it. And if you can't find, because the jokes that I make about my dad are genuinely from a place of love. He is sometimes a fucking moron. And I would like to like
wring his neck,
just shake him and go, yeah. You know what? You should call your son. How about that? Guess who wants to hear from you? Your great grandchildren. He's never met them.
Mm.
Could be a point of contention.
It could be.
It could be.
I can see how
someone might be
mad about
that. Might
create some angst.
Yeah, some people might be a little disappointed, but he doesn't give a shit.
Uh-huh.
But he will also tell you he doesn't. He's like, I don't wish anybody ill, but I don't care.
Uh-huh.
I hope it all works out for them. And I was like, yeah, you're not good at this, Dad. So fair enough. He's like, well, no, if they come and hang out with me, I'll hang out
with them.
That
is cool, yeah.
And you're like,
I won't shut the door in their face.
You are not good at this. And but he knows, like, he knows my brother who lives right there in Milwaukee with him. He knows those grandchildren. If they live in Milwaukee and he is still alive and they have children, he will meet those children and not hate them. Oh. He will not hate anybody. Yeah. That is one of the things I love about my father is that he literally wishes no one ill.
That's a great trait.
It's an amazing trait. He's just like, I hope it all works out. Good luck. And then he lives his life. But to write from that place, mm-hmm. I could either be mad about that, and I have been, mm-hmm. And write from this place of where this guy's a piece of shit. Let's all pitchforks and torches. Mm-hmm. Or this guy's a mess. I love him anyway. We could at least celebrate the fact that he does not wish anyone ill. So yeah. What about you? How do you write? Do you write from the anger?
I write much of it on stage, and I try to write from what entertains me on human interactions.
Sure.
And then personalize it.
Yeah.
Every now and again, there's something like when the first time I got picked up a mic. It was probably a year or so after I got dumped by like my first real girlfriend, and it was therapeutic, mm-hmm. and a lot of it was just about that. And like, I kind of feel like,
oh yeah, you know, it's therapy comedy.
It's so different from where I am now. Like now, what I write about is kind of being a pampered husband. Because mm-hmm. my wife, she has a good job and she is sweet and stuff. So
she's good people
in so many ways. Like but I'll still complain about silly stuff. Like it ended up being a joke, but one day I was like, I missed my yoga class because the lawn furniture took too long to arrive today. And I was like upset. And then when I said it out loud and I was like, oh, there might be a bit there. So right. I try to just write from like things that entertain me.
Well, I think that's true with books as well. Like when you write anything, the great thing about stand-up is that you have to say it out loud. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you say something out loud, you can hear how dumb you sound or how dumb somebody else sounds or how the disconnect or how you hear how it sounds when you say something out loud. I always tell people who are writing anything mm-hmm. like fiction or an article, something they're submitting, if you have an assignment for school, read it out loud. You will hear.
Oh yeah.
You will hear where the commas should go. Mm-hmm. You will hear the phrasing problems. You will hear all of the errors. Or at least it's an excellent pass.
It's a great, excellent.
Like if you write your shitty first draft and then you read aloud your shitty first draft, you will have a better second draft mm-hmm. than if you just wrote it.
Yeah.
If you just rewrote it. If you read it out loud and made notes as you read it, you could correct things that you wouldn't hear because you won't see them because mm-hmm. you'll hear them. It's audible. And that's the great thing about stand-up. I have this to say, Matt Belliker, this has gone by very much quicker. We didn't talk about prison shows.
Next time.
We didn't talk about the Lakers.
There's no shows talking about Lakers.
I don't even know what academic layers... Layers? No. Leagues.
Oh, academic leagues. It's the nerdiest thing you can do in high school and very dorky. It's like Jeopardy for high school students who aren't good at sports.
Rangers, seriously. We're going to have Matt Belliker back on.
Yes.
It's at Greg Giraldo Book is the name of everywhere it is. So if you go to greggiraldobook.com and at Greg Giraldo Book for the Twitter feed, you can find out more about Greg Giraldo than you've ever known. And feel free to find Greg Giraldo's published works and listen to those because they're also wonderful.
Absolutely.
Thanks for doing the show.
Thanks for having me, Jackie.
And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?